I always like to begin with Du Bois, and I didn't have that start until Deborah began the symposium, when you mentioned Du Bois's 1956 letter and the centennials that he was looking forward to. And one of them that we didn't talk about was Paul Laurence Dunbar's birth.
Yes, I left that out of my presentation.
So here I am.
And
someone else mentioned being, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yes,
when you're an English professor, everything looks like a text.
Exactly.
So this week, text heavy. And in fact, well, now here's my Du Bois reference, that Du Bois, on more than one occasion, said he had one particular piece of his that he liked best. And you're all thinking Souls of Black Folk, aren't you? No, his favorite piece of writing was Dark Princess, a 1928 novel. Not only a novel, but a romance novel. I was going to say you should read it, but I'm not so sure you should. I guess it's like a Marxist romance novel, if you can imagine. Well, now, I'm digressing. So I did get to begin with Du Bois after all. This presentation began as a meditation on the name Crisis. And the more I thought about that name, the more, and the fact that this is the 100th anniversary of NAACP and Crisis, I started thinking about the kind of the tension that that name seems to imply between the immediacy and the specificity of the journal's name and its history. This sort of long life and the broad cultural aims of both the organization and the journal, and that immediacy of Crisis. And I thought, what does it mean to experience and document a century-long crisis? And how does a periodical go about defining and showing, in English professor lingo, representing such a crisis? What precisely is the crisis, and has it changed over time? So in trying to answer those questions, I started thinking then about the journal's origins and the fact that it was titled after a poem. James Russell Lowell was an abolitionist, a 19th century American abolitionist poet, and it's the Crisis Journal is named specifically after this poem, The Present Crisis, from 1844. And this is really just a brief excerpt, it's a very long poem. And what I did was I chose passages that highlighted issues of time. And it turns out that this poem itself turns on quite complex and vexed issues of time. For example, the crisis of the poem is slavery, is the urgency of abolition. And the poem acknowledges that slavery in 1844, when it was published, had already been an over 200-year-long crisis. So Lowell writes in the first stanza of the energy of sublime of a century. And he's talking about the abolitionist fervor of the first few decades of the 19th century. But in some ways, that urgency had always been there. Really since 1619, the urgency to end slavery. And then in its later stanzas, the poem goes on, and if you see the bolded sections, are putting these time ideas into play and in tension with one another. The poem elaborates on the idea of the absolute urgency, repeatedly juxtaposing the centuries-long wrong of slavery with the pressing present-day choice between sustaining a bloody past with wrong forever on the throne and entering a slavery-free future of truth and goodness. This is the cover of the very first issue of Crisis, November 1910. And I think it shows us that Lowell's only seemingly paradoxical blending of past, present, and future remains firmly in place, even when the crisis has changed. Crisis and the NAACP were born at a time when Jim Crow segregation was the law of the land, and lynching was in its peak years in the United States. And those were at least part of the crisis in 1910. And of course, this crisis too had been going on for decades and would in fact persist for more decades after 1910. But despite that urgent context of injustice and violence that launched the journal, its first cover features a sketch of a black child in a very tidy Victorian outfit playing with a stick and hoop, which is an ancient children's game that was much more popular in the 19th century than it was in the 20th. So when I look at this text, to me, it's doing a lot of work, a lot of temporal work. It's representing an imagined, not fully imagined, but it's representing a materially comfortable black past and a positive and materially comfortable present in 1910. And it also suggests a positive and healthy black future symbolized by the next generation. And this blending of past, present, and future set the stage for the literary and visual art that appeared in the crisis over the next couple of decades, what I'm terming a strategic anachronism. And I think that's the kind of temporal strategy that marks the journal's content, at least in its earlier years. And like this, to me, quite fascinating inaugural cover, this rich combination of kinds of writing and images in the first decades of the crisis, I think speaks just as clearly to the journal's agenda of strategically imagining, and at times reimagining, an African-American past, present, and future. Under Du Bois's editorship, and perhaps even more important, under Jesse Fawcett's literary editorship, the journal included just an extraordinary range of writing, political and protest writing, social scientific analysis, but also lots of creative writing, human interest stories, entertainment pieces, including a children's feature that eventually developed into a freestanding publication of Browning's book. There are also beautiful photographs in the crisis in this period, and I think that like the writing, the images are quite complicated in their mixture. You'll find photographs of beautiful children. This is one of Manhattan's finest, is the caption, which you probably can't quite make out. Proud college graduates. This is a cover from the Education number in 1924. And this over here on this side is the back cover. It's an interesting juxtaposition. But there are also photographs of lynching victims, and sometimes literally right next to one another. And I think it's almost as if to counteract that traumatic crisis being experienced in the present in 1910. Similarly, the literary pieces in the crisis in the first few decades of its publication were quite various, but despite their differences, I think they disclose and they depend upon the same temporal tension, strategic anachronism, that I think might have produced the journal itself. And I want to focus here now on some text. Two examples, one I know you know, Langston Hughes's most well-known poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, and also one of Claude McKay's most well-known poems, To the White Fiends. The content of these two poems, like that of Lowell's poem, turns on the relationship among past, present, and future. However, unlike Lowell's style, which if you read much of it, you might probably found rather overheated and flowery, and that makes it very much of its time. It's very much a romantic piece, an 1844 poem. I think that McKay and Hughes are after something else altogether. And I think these two poems, along with much of the literature in the crisis between 1910 and 1934, reveal tensions among multiple time periods, not just in their content, in what they're about, but also in how they're written, in their form. Now, we'll move on to Langston Hughes. I will get there. There we go. The Negro Speaks of Rivers appeared in the crisis in 1923, and the poem is specifically about an African-American past, and I think that it really can only be about an African-American past. It traces a distinct chronology that begins with the birth of civilization in Africa, moves on to the flourishing culture of ancient Egypt, and ends with slavery and emancipation in the U.S. The poem thus begins with pre- and ancient history and ends in 1863, just when Lowell's present-day crisis had finally been resolved, at least apparently. Yet the poem formally is most definitely of 1923, with its irregular line lengths, mirroring the windings of a river, and with a free verse form that neither rhymes nor follows a rigid meter. It is, then, a formally modern poem whose content flows from and out of the past, yet does not extend all the way up to the present, and by that I mean Hughes's present. By contrast, Claude McKay's, it's perhaps not his most well-known sonnet, which is, of course, If We Must Die, but it is among his most well-known and popular poems. By contrast, I think this poem delivers present-day content, what I would call a crisis, through one of the oldest and most rigid of European poetic forms, the sonnet. This particular form invented by Petrarch in Italy in the 14th century and quickly became a major form of love poetry and still is today. This was, To the White Fiends, was published in Crisis in November 1918, and far from being a love poem, is responding to and militantly protesting lynching and the white riots of the 1910s, 19-teens that were directed against black communities. The riots peaked in what James Weldon Johnson termed the Red Summer of 1919, in which dozens of U.S. black communities in over a dozen states, from Mississippi and Arkansas to New York and Arizona, were targeted for racial violence. The riots persisted from the 1910s through the 1930s, another ongoing crisis. McKay adopts the very old sonnet form to describe present-day white racial terrorism and to call for new armed black resistance in the future. Thou shalt be a light. Go forth. Go forth. Like Hughes, McKay is strategically deploying layered temporality in terms of his form and his content in order to accommodate and express the same tensions among past, present, and future that the crisis as a whole, at least in my argument, was trying to represent and also perhaps to resolve. And of course, it is in fact possible to resolve to end a crisis, just as the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, imaginatively rendered by Hughes as the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, apparently resolved the immediate crisis of slavery. But then another crisis inevitably follows. NAACP President Benjamin Todd Gell suggested just that in the spring 2009 issue of Crisis when he wrote the following about the NAACP and its history, and that's the next slide, is this quotation. The new organization, radical for its time, launched a tenacious multi-decade struggle to successfully end the horror of lynch mobs. In 1932, we took up the mantle to reverse Jim Crow, and 2 decades later, segregation was made illegal. In the wake of Brown versus Board of Education, a determined effort for political inclusion was launched, triumphing last year in the election of an African-American president and the most black elected official since Reconstruction. The NAACP has always embraced the impossible, fearlessly marching forward at an unwavering pace. In the same issue, Shannon Gibney described the agenda of the NAACP upon its second centennials, including in the domestic arena, education, housing, and justice, and in the international arena, enhancing trade, economic development, and human rights in Africa and the Caribbean, taking action in Darfur, Sudan, and reforming U.S. and European immigration law and policies so that people of color are treated as equitably as their white counterparts. As Crisis and the NAACP's definition and representation of the black community changes over time, from Du Bois's relatively elite notion of the talented tenth, at least as represented in these images, to a fully national cross-class community, to an international and diasporic one, so too must the crisis change. And 100 years of Crisis the Journal bear out this idea of shifting community and changing crisis. In the pages of the journal from 1910 to 2009, lynching gives way to World War II, then segregation, then the atom bomb, then the civil rights struggle, then police brutality, and as of the July-August 2008 issue, the crisis in Sudan. As with the very first cover of the crisis, recent covers from the early 21st century testify to the changing nature of Black community and of crisis, and they testify as well to the journal's aim at once to correct and produce an historical record, document present-day atrocity and accomplishment, and to imagine a future post-crisis era. The January-February 2002 issue features Langston Hughes on the cover and a centennial tribute to him. It also includes stories on the history of lynching and on the ongoing AIDS crisis in urban U.S. Black communities. Now, significantly, this issue also features a name change. The journal carried the name New Crisis from July 1997 through March-April 2003, suggesting not only a fresh start after the suspension of publication in the wake of the NAACP's 1996 financial difficulties, but perhaps also, and this is when I become an interpreter, an English professor interpreting text, perhaps a sense of the paradox of a century-long crisis, along with a new, more expansive definition of Black community. The January-February 2005 issue returns to the old name, Crisis, but maintains the what I hope is now familiar temporal blend, as well as a more diasporic international sense of community. It includes a Black U.S. family's history of slavery, a feature in honor and memory of Shirley Chisholm, and a story on the genocide in Sudan. The richly mixed contents of Crisis, New Crisis demonstrate at once the desirability and the impossibility of showing everyone and everything at once. Its features and photos, like its poems, are forever caught on Lowell's thorny stem of time. The most recent cover offers a particularly optimistic rendition of that thorny stem, with glowing sun-like rays as background for the NAACP emblem held aloft by a sculptural Black figure reminiscent of Aaron Douglas's Harlem Renaissance-era African art-inspired drawings. The cover by John LeBay reflects a bright future that is both uplifted and uplifting by past and present. Stories in this issue include The Talented Tenth, how Emmett Till's death transformed the movement and shaping the minds of tomorrow. Now, interestingly for me, what hasn't been included in Crisis for quite some time is literature. And I wonder, and this is perhaps bold on my part, if I might suggest that the crisis of the 21st century might find room on its pages once again for contemporary literary and visual strategies of temporal layering that were in the past deployed by Hughes, McKay, and Douglas, and that are now being carried on by many Black writers and artists, including Toni Morrison, Samuel Delaney, Walter Mosley, Marlon James, Kara Walker, Rashid Johnson, and Carrie James Marshall. As the early years of the journal show, literary and visual culture is uniquely positioned to blend past, present, and future in order to represent and even to imagine and propose solutions for a crisis that is at once old, immediate, and ongoing.